And I will talk you about a work that I made with many other people. Some of them are here also. And in a sense, it's a continuation of what we started last year, where we addressed the S-matrix bootstrap in the case of QCD, where we found many structures. We managed to use the effective field theory to input some notions of chirality, etc. But we thought that it could be more instructive to consider some toy model of QCD. For example, one plus one dimensions that has, again, an effective field theory description, and try to see how much we can explain analytically and what we can quantitatively say, actually. So, plan of the talk, so that you don't get lost. I will first review, for some of you that don't recall, maybe this story, what we know about flux tubes. Then I will tell you about the bootstrap setup. And well, it's a bit different from the setup that you had until now, because there are massless particles in one plus one dimensions. And then I will focus on two cases that will be clear momentarily. Then d equals 3, target space, d equals 4. And in d equals 3, we will manage to get all the bounds analytically. And in d equals 4 will be mostly numerics. But there are some lessons that we can draw from analytics. Then I will comment about energy bounds that we can derive. And in the last part of the talk, I will comment something about resonances. But this is more speculative. It's the less rigorous part of the talk. So let me draw a flux tube for you. So what I do have in mind when I think about flux tube is that you have some heavy quark sources, one Q bar here. And we all know that the chromoelectric flux localizes into a string-like object connecting the two sources. And if the two sources are far away enough, we can forget about what generated this string-like object. And if we make time pass, this string will draw a worksheet. So what people, the kind of questions that people can ask are, for example, if we are far away enough, we can forget about the length of the string. There would be some parameter that, as you can imagine, will be the cutoff of the effective field theory. And we can just focus on the lowest degree of freedom that, in this case, are dominated by the Goldstone bosons. And the Goldstone bosons are the transverse fluctuations of this worksheet. But how many of them there are? So this symmetry breaking pattern, in this case, it's just a Poincaré in the dimension that breaks to Poincaré on the worksheet times the transverse rotations. And well, these are space-time generators, so the number of ghosts doesn't match the number of broken generators, but it's easy to imagine that they are d minus 2, because they really correspond to the physical transverse fluctuations of the worksheet. So we have these d minus 2 Goldstone particles. And we can, for example, ask what are the lessons that we can learn from the effective field theory description of this object. So it is to explain this, it's like better to do a step backward than just think about this system in a more covariant formalism, which is the best formalism to talk about these effective actions. So the action, as you can imagine, will be like an area term, which is the first thing that you can write. And this is what I will call, all the consequences of this term, it's what I will call during the talk universal. So this is the universal part. And then in principle, you can write other terms. So let me put a 1 over L string square for dimensional reasons. And then, for example, you can ask which kind of terms you can write and Well, in general, you could write the Ricci scalar. Then you could write some k-squared term. Well, let me explain just the notation to not be useful later, but let me explain. So H is the determinant of the induced metric, which is the alpha x mu, the beta x mu. And k mu, just to fix the idea, is just a covariant derivative of the tangent vector. Just to say what is this k. And depends on the x. And then, of course, you can add more operators as you go higher in derivative. So there will be some L squared, k to the fourth operator, and other stuff. So the magic in this case is that in two dimensions, Ricci is a total derivative. So we can drop it up to subtleties. And k squared is proportional to the equation of motion. In fact, if you tear, you can always like make a few definitions and push it further away in the derivative expansion, so it can be dropped. So you see, after the universal term, the first corrections come for this k to the fourth operator that, if you want, they can, the kind of operators that can appear have this form. So they will be of the form n plus 4 xn. This will be of the form dn plus 2 xn. And this universal term of the form dn xn. So they are called like weight 0, weight 2, weight 4. So the first corrections come from these weight 4 operators. And actually, there are two of them. As you can imagine, like there is some k square square, and there is some k mu square. And we'll put some coefficients in front of them, alpha 3 and beta 3. And these non-universal coefficients will be what will basically bound, well, what I will show how to bound during this talk. And using them, we will derive some consequences, for example, about the energies when you put the theory on a cylinder, for example. So this is the high degree of universality, and it's due to this fact that you can neglect these two operators. Now, as a particle physicist, when you have like an action, we want to scatter stuff. So we look at the S matrix. So we have this Brannon fluctuations on top of the worksheet. They have some momentum. We go to the center of mass frame. The scattering will be described by the energy that I call S. And they have, in general, polarization, because there are xi transverse directions. So the S matrix can be, in general, parameterized by a tensor that has this form, where there are three functions, one of which multiplying some tensor structure. And if you do a two-loop computation, for example, in this theory, you can show that the phase shifts take the following form. So here, for example, you can notice that the first term is like universal. It's like depends on your 1 over 4 times the scale. Then there is an S squared term, which in principle depends on some parameter alpha 2. But this parameter is also universal. And it's fixed to be d minus 26 divided by 384 pi. This alpha 2 follows from an explicit one-loop computation. So you can show that if you compute the one-loop 2-2-2 amplitude using this action, the finite term does not get scheme-dependent corrections. And this is due basically to the fact that this operator is like a total derivative, so it's needed for normalization, but then the scheme dependence vanishes when you go in two dimensions. So, as I was saying, and the first correction starts only at order s cube, which is basically compatible with the fact that we neglected this operator, and the first universal corrections come at this order. So everything is consistent. Now, notice that this ansatz, well, could follow from an explicit loop computation that, as you can imagine, it's hard, the scheme dependence, or evanescent operators in this case. But actually, can be also derived using only unitarity, well, saturation, elastic unitarity, and crossing, because we know from, accounting of operator, that the imaginary part of this phase shift, or the particle production, we'd only start at order s to the 6. So, but of course, the alpha 2 coefficients, you cannot compute it. You need to compute it explicitly. Comes from the theory. And another observation I want to make is that, for example, in pion physics, the first non-universal corrections will appear already at order s squared. So if we were to try to repeat the same game in higher dimensions, we will already get some operators at this order, many more operators at this order. So in this framework, everything is very clear. There is a huge universality up to order s squared. And then there are only two parameters that parameterize the non-universal deviations. So, OK. Now, the last part of my introduction, it will be about what are these energies that I will talk about later. So what people do also is that you cannot scatter stuff on a flux tube. So people put the theory in a lattice, and they study the energy levels in the cylinder. So you compactify the theory. Well, you compactify a string in this longitudinal direction. And then now it really looks like a tube. That's why flux tube. And a consequence of this low energy universality is that the energy of this flux tube is a function of the large radius. That is much greater than the length, is given by the square root formula, which is r squared minus pi over 3 times d minus 2. And this formula, of course, it's not valid at any radius, but you can expand it. And up to order 1 over r to the 5, the energy levels are described by this formula. And then eventually, at order 1 over r to the 7, correction will kick in. And we parameterize them as delta, some deviation, depending on the target space dimension, r to the 7 plus correction over 1 r to the 9. So to anticipate the third part of the talk, basically, this delta d, it depends on alpha 3 and beta 3. I will write it explicitly. This is some d minus 2. And then there is some alpha 3, beta 3 dependence. So now you can imagine what can be the logic. The logic can be that you can bound these alpha 3, beta 3 parameters. And then using, for example, the action, compute this correction, and then bound also the non-universal correction to the energy. Right, you're right. So what I mean for this, when I say this, what I mean is that the amplitude of 2 to 4 scattering Branons starts at order s cube, so it tender square in elasticity, and you get correction to order s to the 6. So this will be the logic. Now let me go to the setup. So how we address this problem. So the particles are massless, right, in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And there are right and there are left movers. And when you shoot a massless particle, it is hard to boost it and, make it a left or right mover. So once you shoot in one direction, it shoots in that direction forever. And the only of course, you can imagine that they could scatter like left-left movers, right-right movers. But we will consider only like left-right scattering. Now, what about the analytic structure? The analytic structure is very simple. Because in 1 plus 1 dimension, in general, you will have like a normal threshold starting at 4m squared, Then we start at the crossed one at 0. We'll have cut. And now what happens now is simply that this cut closes because you send the mask to 0. And well, you see that there is no room for bound states. So the function, it will be, the function is like holomorphic in the upper half plane or the lower half plane. What we need to understand is how to implement crossing. So to implement crossing, well, we can just look at this figure. So like A, B, then you will have C, D, okay? So if you look at the process in this direction, you can see that these tensor structures, one is invariant and the other two exchange. So the crossing properties in that basis of sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3 are given by that this function is invariant under crossing, that now just is basically the flipping of S to minus S. And those other two functions exchange. As you can also, yeah, explicitly see if you put S to minus S. Okay. So, well, I mean, this might seem still a bit odd in the sense that, okay, we have the function here, it's related by crossing to function in the lower half plane, but there is one property that we can use, which is real analyticity, which helps us a lot in this case, because it simply says that the function below the cut is the complex conjugate to the function above the cut. Just sigma I star s, which at the end of the day, it means that we can restrict ourselves only to consider the upper half plane. So we can forget about the lower half plane, and all the fixes will come from considering the S-matrix analytic function in this upper half plane. So the setup looks like the simplest as possible that you can imagine. So now let's go to see how explicitly works this this story in three space-time dimensions. On target space is three dimensions. And in this case, everything is extremely simple, and we should be able to bound everything analytically. Because in this case, there is only one transverse direction. So there are basically no polarization for these massless particles. The S matrix is just a phase. And on top of that, in this case, particle production, so m2 to 4 modulus square, start even later, start at order s to the 8. So everything is like fixed completely by elastic unitarity. And the phase shift ansatz that one can write as the following form, that is s to the 4 universal term. And then let me call it gamma 3, but it's basically alpha 3 minus beta 3, but there is only one of them. Starts at order s cubed, then there will be some order s to the 5, some order s to the 7, and then eventually some imaginary part at order s to the 8, dot, dot, dot. Now you see. In general, it's s to the 6. In this special case, which is like it's a single particle, starts later. Just that. So now look at this. So unitarity, it's the condition, right, the S matrix. When you are basically for positive energies, it has to be a phase. And this function clearly is a phase. Or less than as modulus less than 1, unless this coefficient is negative. So what we unitarity, what can tell us, it's just that this coefficient gamma 8 has to be greater or equal than 0, but wouldn't tell anything about phases, like any phase is compatible with unitarity. But there is some instructive lesson that one can draw. For example, imagine for a second that this this coefficient is some non-universal coefficient. I mean, this first term is some non-universal coefficient, like gamma 1. So imagine that the 2 delta S starts with gamma 1. This is super fine with respect to unitarity. But now, if you require UV completion, so if you require that your function is basically bounded on all over the real axis, this becomes the boundary for the upper half plane. The function is bounded on the boundary. So by maximum modulus principle, it has to be bounded everywhere in the complex plane. So if you start to move in the complex plane, for example, you will readily see that if you move on the imaginary axis, this gamma 1 is to be positive as well. Otherwise, it would explode in the complex plane. A 1 over 4 is compatible, so we are happy. So you can imagine that some kind of generalization of these arguments can be drawn if you find some tools to study the function in the complex plane, so some other generalization of maximum modulus principle. So the idea to find these generalizations is the following. What I want. So let's take our function. So our function is holomorphic in the upper half plane and bounded by 1 on the real axis. And write, starting from it, another function, S1, which now is function of 2 variables. Well, holomorphic in Z, but not holomorphic in W, which is given by S to Z divided by minus S of W divided by SZ S bar W. Then you divide by Z minus W, Z minus W bar. You write this function. This function, you can see that if W has modulus less than 1, has no poles in the upper half plane, so it's holomorphic. So it's holomorphic in the upper half plane. And it is bounded by 1 on the real axis. So the absolute value of S1 is less or equal to 1. So you can use, again, the maximum modulus principle on this function. That, and you can see which kind of consequence you should derive. And surprisingly, what you see is that, for example, let's move on the imaginary axis, as for the maximum modulus principle. Let me call it Ix, Iy. And well, you see that if you expand, well, first around x and then sending y close to 0, you see that you get something like this. Plus 8 gamma 3 xy plus dot 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 greater or equal than minus 1. And from this inequality, you readily get that gamma 3 has to be greater or equal than minus 1 over 768. And this is a bound that the first time we derived it numerically, but really we had no explanation for that because phases are hard to imagine that they can be bounded. But indeed, when one starts to construct this more fancy function, one can get access to these higher phases. Actually, this is not something that this is a theorem in mathematics. So this theorem, actually, it's not formulated in these terms. So here I'm using this theorem to derive some bounds on these third derivatives, if you want. But this theorem people formulate it in the disk. And the statement is that if you have a function that is bounded by holomorphic inside the disk and bounded by 1 on the boundary, then this analytic function satisfies this inequality, f of z minus f of w. It's a bit different in the disk, but bar of w, and this is to be less or equal than this, this thing. Yes, there is a, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, there is a geometrical interpretation, if you want, that one can get from the work of some two mathematicians, Birdon and Minda, are their names. And the idea is that this kind of, so for example, the maximum modulus principle is saturated by one, by the function one. This, well, this is called the Schwarzschild inequality. Let me give it a name. And this bound is saturated by the homomorphism of the disk that they take precisely this form. And in S-matrix language, you call them CDD factors. And, well, okay, and then you can see that you can, you can go over, you can bound this, this gamma tree. But if you start, for example, to construct other functional, so adding more points, this higher order function are saturated by function. So this function has only one single zero in the disk, but the higher order function will be saturated by functions that have like multiple zeros. So two zeros, three zeros, four zeros. And to get this function, you need to tune higher and higher derivatives in zero. So, yeah. Well, maybe I don't have a straightforward explanation. Yeah. Okay, sorry, maybe I went in a different direction. But yeah. So, well, exactly. So, yeah, what I was trying to say, it's like a bit, well, in the spirit of what I was going to say after. Which is basically that, okay, you see that you can bound this derivative doing this construction. And then if you start to iterate this construction and adding more points to this, so basically take this S1 and write some S2, which will depend on W1 and W2. Now, it happens that you can start to bound also gamma 5, and then if you iterate again gamma 7, and then you would stop because eventually, well, yeah, particle pressure just starts to kick in, so these bounds are not anymore optimal. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, in the sense that, yeah, these inequalities are related to basically function with multiple zeros. So if you like a function with n zeros, satisfy the n function, let's say. So yeah, you can send them to infinity, but I don't know what happened in that case. So, well, okay. So to conclude this section, basically, there is bound on gamma 3, then there will, we will get using this function a bound on gamma 5, which would be like a polynomial in gamma 3. Well, it's like a parabola. Gamma 3. And then gamma 7 will be like a cubic, more complicated. But let me exercise my drawing skills. What you would get if you plot, it's a very fancy surface. You mean if there are other branch cuts on the real axis? No, this theorem does not care about that in the sense that on the boundary, the only requirement is that the function is bounded by one. and it's holomorphic inside. So any other cut? No. Ah, this is a, if you want, this is an asymptotic expansion at small s. The function is not differential in the sense that this function is not holomorphic in W. So you can expand for small z, but then W will depend on the direction. And the fact is that whichever direction you take to get this derivative, you get always the same bound. Yeah. Well, that sounds a bit strange because there is only one scale in the theory. So all the branch cuts would start at zero because they're massless particles. We assume there are all the massive excitations that can be in the bulk, they are like beyond the cutoff. So we see only the massless cuts. And of course, I mean, as you also was saying, this expansion, it's not regular in zero. And eventually there will be like log terms appearing. And actually these log terms are kind of universal, at least the first ones. And I just didn't draw them, but they would start later, let's say. And well, we just didn't go higher enough in orders, so we don't care about them. So let me draw this surface for you. So it looks like this. There is a boundary here. Then there is some shape here, some base. And it's like a rock, basically. And there is a kink. I mean, this it's nice because there is like some kink in this point. Then there is some edge. Right, I'm putting the axis. One second. So the axis are, this is gamma 7. This is gamma 3, gamma 5, so 5, and this is gamma 3. So this is basically the allowed space for this gamma 3, gamma 5, and gamma 7 that you obtain basically from these bounds that you get applying this function. And well, we first found all these things numerically, and then this was such a simple system that we want to explain analytically at least. But yeah, it's like some cubic algebraic surface. OK, so I'll keep this figure now, because then I will make some comment about resonances. Now let's move to D equals 4. So I will keep this bound, because this is the one that we're interested in. But in principle, all those other coefficients are bounded. So let me go to D equals 4. So in D equals 4, now there are two polarizations. So the S matrix is invariant under O2, and now this tensor structure starts to get useful. And unfortunately, as soon as you complicate a bit this system, you cannot anymore get bound analytically. Or at least, you cannot optimally bound anything analytically, but you need to do also some numerics. But nevertheless, there is something that we can do. So recall that now, well, at this point, there was only gamma 3, because we are in three dimensions. It's kind of degenerate case. But now there will be alpha 3 and beta 3. So there are these two parameters that are non-universal, and we are trying to bound. So in D equals 4, again, what you get is that this is the plane, beta 3. This is alpha 3. And this is something that has been, for example, commented in the paper by Lucia and Pedro. And it's the fact that the singlet S matrix in the singlet channel, not like in D equals 3, where it's all bounded by 1, but now it's bounded by 2 because of crossing for S negative, and it's bounded by 1 for S positive. And actually, we don't know any generalization of this theorem that applies to this case. And the same happens for the antisymmetric channel. They are bounded in the same fashion. But in the symmetric channel, it happens that it's bounded by 1. So we can apply this theorem, and we get some analytic bound on this alpha 3 only. That maybe I should erase something. It depends on alpha 3 only, and it's given again by this fancy number. And now it's decorated by some pi's. And the pi does not come from anything transcendental, but it's just the fact that alpha 2, that now it's important, because, well, in 3 dimensions, there is a d minus 3, so it's 0. It's important that this alpha 2 contains some pi's, so that's why there is a pi in this bound. And this is something like 3 times 10 to the minus 5. And this bound alone would say that, well, in this parameter space, in this two-dimensional space, all this part is excluded. This is some half plane allowed, and okay, fine. But then, of course, we are not inputting anything from the fact that also the other channels are bounded. So to do that, we need to do analytics. So in this case, it's very simple, because we have the upper half plane that we can map it to the open disk. And then we can start to, well, we can bound. We can write an ansatz for this function. For the S matrix, we write some ansatz as some polynomial, phi n, chi to the n, where chi to the n are, well, is the map from the upper half plane to the disk, if you want. And repeat the usual game. But let me tell you what is the result. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes, you're right. Right, so there are these 3 functions that you can write an ansatz for them. But then you want that when you combine them, for example, in the irreducible representations in the S channel, for example, these 3 functions has to be bounded by 1. So crossing is manifest in this sigma 2, sigma 1, sigma 3 basis. But then we bound when you write them in this basis. And when we do this, yes. Now you can do something similar in the sense that, yeah, let me draw it. Yeah, it's written here basically, but. What you get is that, well, one component is self-crossed, and the other component on this boundary will have sigma 1, and on this boundary will have like sigma 3 star. No, thanks for the question. Sometimes I want to run. Okay. So we do the numerics. In this case, which is, well, it's very simple numerics. And the bound that we get, it looks like a parabola, but it's not a parabola, actually. It does not fit well with the parabola. Looks like this. So we can exclude more, fine. And there is one point where the two things collide, where the two bounds coincide. And this point, it happens to be also the only integrable point, in the sense that, this massless theory is integrable only when this beta 3 is equal to 0. It's integrable in the sense that it satisfies Young-Baxter, otherwise it wouldn't satisfy Young-Baxter. And, again, This alpha 3 and beta 3 have, again, I mean, they can be bounded, but it's clear now that it's not unitarity alone, because these are analogs of those phases. So there is always this concept that there is some UV completion you need to consider, and then analyticity helps you to put bounds. So this is the message. Okay, so now we got this nice bound on gamma 3. We have this, this numerical bound, this allowed region for alpha 3, beta 3. And now let's see what we can say about this, this energy, so the ground state energy of this flux tube system. So this I won't erase it. So as I anticipated before, we want to actually compute the 1 over r to the 7 correction. So one needs to go to very high order in principle in perturbation T. But if one is careful and, you use the same renormalization for the scattering amplitude and the free energy in finite volume, you would see that this non-universal correction is given by the insertion of this K to the fourth operator that I canceled, but, well, there are two of them. And you just compute this diagram. So this diagram will be divergent, so you basically cancel the divergence consistently. And you would get the formula, that I wrote down there, where basically there will be that function of let me write it. So just from the tensor structure, you would get something that depends on the target space dimension in alpha 3 and beta 3. And the thermal correction will give you the pi's. So it'll be 8 pi to the 6, 2 to 5, r to the 8. So, and this is basically the game, in the sense that we can plug now the bound on gamma 3. And in four dimensions, in principle, one should, in a sense, input this bound. But we are lucky, because in d equals 4, this does not depend anymore on beta 3. And it's kind of nice coincidence that this deviation depends only on alpha 3, which is the only quantity we can bound analytically. So that's why you can get analytic bound. And in this case, for example, for delta 3, so for the correction of the energy in three dimensions, one would get that it's less or equal than some pi to the 6, 5,400, which is almost 0.18. And in delta 4, it's less or equal than this other number, pi to the 4, the different pi's, which is basically minus 0.016. And this, in a sense, is, it says that any flux tube, any system that you compactify on a radius that has the same pattern of, that has the same kind of low energy universality, the corrections has to be bounded by these numbers. From above. Yeah. And because there is d minus 2, 2 minus d, and this flipped the sign. Okay. So, and for example, it's nice to compare it with the estimate that Sergei Dubovsky and Gorbenko they derived. For example, where in SU6 Young-Mills, they get some 3 to the 10 to the minus 4. So it's positive. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Let me make another comment, which is a nice observation, I guess, about this. I mean, these numbers, I mean, can say little to you, maybe. But the fact that one is positive, one is negative, has an interesting interpretation in the sense that if you wouldn't know anything, you would see from here that, well, here you allow no correction to the square root formula because the bound, the upper bound is positive. Here the bound, the upper bound is negative, so you need to correct the flux tube energy. And this actually is compatible with the fact that in three dimensions, one can construct an integrable flux tube theory, described by the square root formula. But in four dimensions, we must have a correction because particle production is like universal. So this kind of bound is compatible also with that. And well, you cannot restrict yourself only to the ground state energy, but you can also consider like excited states. So for example, you can compute the splitting between the two particle states with the, well, in the center of mass frame, well, the two phonons have like momenta 2 minus 2, minus the one with the four particles with these units of momenta, that in principle they would be degenerate, but they have some, well, the non-universal correction start at order 1 over r to the 7. They are governed by some coefficient time gamma 3, and you can bound it. But unfortunately, like lattice data are not, well, are not good enough to allow us to make this comparison in this regime. But in principle, one can derive more general consequences. So I think this is, how much time do I have? Well, there is also no bound on beta 3 at all. In the sense that if you move in this direction, this is an infinite curve. No, because I mean, these are derivatives, right? So it always happens that, for example, the lower bound exists, but the upper bound is infinite. I can make you an example if you want. Like you have, again, a function in the disk that you plot on the real axis between minus 1 and 1, right? And imagine that you fix your function to be 1 at 1, and you want to maximize the derivative. So if you maximize the derivative, you have like an upper bound, which is like infinite, but the lower bound, it will be 0. And it cannot be negative, because otherwise you would basically violate the maximum modulus principle when you go inside the disk. So even in this simple example, there is like a lower bound that is meaningful, and in 0, and the upper bound is just infinite. And this is the same. These are alpha 3 and beta 3 are kind of derivatives. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I agree. No, but in a sense, I mean, if you want to compare with some perturbation theory, as you say, there has to be like some ordering. You need to be careful at the expansion. But from an S-matrix point of view, these are just coefficients of the expansion in one point. So of course, I mean, if it's too large, then there is no meaning to compare it with some perturbation expansion, but from the S-matrix point of view, it's fine. Well, Okay, so I'm done. Okay, I will just I will conclude basically talking about the resonance pattern, which is like another interesting observation, but this is like the less rigorous part, as I told you at the beginning. Yeah, here I can count. So as we did basically in four dimensions, we can, for example, study the S-matrix that optimize this boundary, or optimize that, well, that hits the boundary of that allowed space, and see if there are any zeros. And we like to interpret zero as possible resonances in the theory. So in three dimensions, there is not really, well, we cannot really compare with the flux tubes because there is no clear sign for a resonance in that case. But there are some interesting facts. For example, this kink theory, it's some, well, it's the theory, well, it's the S-matrix proposed by Zamolochkov to describe the flow from the critical Ising to the critical Ising. That in our, well, in our scale, in our choice of units, takes this form, so as one only single as a single zero in the upper half plane. And then along this edge, you have two zeros, and on this surface, in general, you have three zeros. So in principle, we can, as we like go in the higher dimensional space, there will be like hypersurfaces where on the bound there will lie like more derivatives. So we have this kind of abstract construction that one can just draw. But in four dimensions, things are more interesting because on the lattice, in order to, for example, match the experimental data with the large radius expansion of the effective field theory, people really needed to introduce some excitation of the flux tube, some resonance, that it was called like a Worksheet axion. And well, maybe not surprisingly, but we find in along our boundary some zero, for example, in the antisymmetric channel, which is the axion channel. And if I draw the movie of this zero as it, so this is the mass of this zero, this is the width in this plane, as I move along that boundary, so let me draw it again. Here there is beta 3 negative, here there is beta 3 positive. I will move like this. This is 2.5, 2, 1.5, and this is 2, this is 4. But what you see basically is that this zero starts here, draws some curve, and then goes down like this. And as you move, the arrows goes like this. Now, there is one point here, which is the Young-Baxter point that corresponds on this curve to this point. So this is the region for beta 3 negative. This is the region, the whole region for beta 3 positive. And like as a fact of life, we plot, we put on top of this plot the zeros found in the SU3 and SU5 case, and they are basically on top of this curve. So like SU3 is here, SU5 is here. This is a, it's really a fact of life. There is no notion of such, I mean, there is no way why you would expect this kind of match. But it happens that if you actually measure the position of the zeros, you find that they lie on this curve, the one that they fit, for example, from the phase shifts. Yes. So this has to be taken with a grain of salt. It's the S-matrix is always elastic on the boundary. Well, it is known that starts very late, so it disorders S to the 6, of course. But there are no, as far as I know, there are no plots that show like some plot of inelasticity that you can see like for the absolute value. It's there is really nothing. We don't know much about. Yeah. So it's surprising in a sense. But yeah, sometimes it's always happened that, for example, when unitarity is not completely saturated, these zeros do not move a lot. So, but I don't know how to make a quantitative statement about that. It's just an observation. But the other nice thing is that, okay, I mean, since there is this kind of match with the data, we can look for other resonances. And indeed, we find, for example, that in the same plane, there is another resonance coming from infinity that we call it axion star. And for which, if we go to this point, we can make some we can make some prediction for this mass. But again, this has to be again taken carefully because, we don't have control on particle production. We can just say that in our setup, our function show other resonances, not only the axion. So there is this resonance here, and then there are also actually resonances in the antisymmetric and in the singlet channel. And there is a funny thing. In the sense that when beta 3, well, if you flip the sign of beta 3, there is a symmetry of the crossing equations where basically symmetric channel and antisymmetric channel exchange. So if you just flip beta 3, you can have a very light, not axion, but dilaton. So these two theories, there might be related in some sense. And it just happens that flux tube have this kind of axionic excitation, but there could be axions that have some breeders. So just some singlet kind of stable excitations. And last comment, and then I will draw my conclusion, which is even more surprisingly for us, and we have really no explanation for that, is that these resonances are very have a width which is very small that actually goes to zero. So in a narrow width approximation, it makes sense to talk about the coupling of the resonance to the Brownons, if you want. So this coupling in this approximation scales like square root of gamma divided by m to the 5 over 2. And if we plot, if we make this plot instead of mass versus width, we make it like mass versus coupling in this sense, this becomes super flat. In the sense that all these resonances, the zero of this, all these resonance positions seems to obey this kind of scaling. That, not only they obey this scaling, but the coefficient here, it's the same that can be predicted, assuming the fact that you want to like cancel particle production. So there is like some prediction for this coupling. That it's a bit fast, but there's some prediction, which is this number. And if you measure this coupling, all these resonances have this kind of number. So a kind of meaningful question that one can ask is that in some limit along this curve, one can recover integrability. But for that, we don't. This is not a question. We don't know how to make sense to this observation yet. So this is all I wanted to say, I guess. Let me draw the conclusions. So I think this is like the first bound on this non-universal Wilson coefficients that we don't know in literature other rigorous bounds of this kind. And the first thing that we want to do, that we are doing next, is that, for example, go again to higher dimensions and now try to bound the non-universal coefficients that appear in the Carroll-Fetti field theory. So for example, try to bound those coefficients. And in the massless setup, it's cleaner because there are less non-universal corrections. So that's an attempt. And another direction would be, for example, to consider other symmetry breaking patterns. I don't know, relaxing the assumption of non-party invariants, relaxing, adding supersymmetries. One can play with this framework. And also another thing would be, for example, to consider multiparticle. And consider multiparticle because this is the simplest possible setup. And if we add in multiparticles, we don't get better bounds. In this case, probably it will be hard to get in more general cases. So we are trying to to do multiple components in this case. And well, we'll see. So then I'm done. Yeah, 2 to 4, 3 to 3.
Can you connect this bound to anything to like say about Meson spectrum?
About the?
Can you connect this to like Meson spectrum?
Ah, Meson. Oh, you mean in 4 dimensions?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see, the spectrum is always like a bit delicate in the sense that. Yeah, you would look for zeros that would appear in the ansatz. But yes, for example, what I was saying about pions is that one could go to the, one could take the chiral effective Lagrangian, look which kind of parameters appear there, write an ansatz compatible with that expansion, and try to put bounds on those coefficients. So in a sense, yes. But directly on resonances looks still hard. I don't know how to do it.
Sorry, another question. So initially you started with assuming that you have a Lagrangian which is like effective Lagrangian which is local, meaning that it has a single integral, for example. Is there any principle telling you that there cannot be like double, like triple integrals, or like, you know, if you consider flux tubes of like which have like self-crossing and so on?
I'm not sure I understood. Sorry.
So your effective action had a single integral, right?
Yeah.
But for example, in like critical string theory, if there's like R flux background, like one expects to have like infinitely many integrals for the like basically action describing the string. So I was wondering in this like flux tube case, what is the rationale behind like basically assuming that it has only like single integral for the worship theory?
I see.
And like possibly related, like how do you know that like flux tubes cannot like have a self-crossing, for example?
Ah, right. You are right. Well, we are well. Yeah, we are imagining that this this effective field theory is for a very long string, and this very long string like they do not self-intersect, for example. So they are like small fluctuations of the string. So this more non-perturbative phenomena, yeah, I don't know how to incorporate it right away. But yeah, our string like are kind of, we imagine that it's like not self-intersecting, very long and very low energy.
Yes, I try maybe to answer to this question, if you don't mind. So I mean, what they did is simply this Kallan-Coleman Bessel-Zumino constructions of effective field theory. Whenever you have a breaking of a symmetry to a subgroup, you have some pseudo, you have ghost on both, and so you write a local Lagrangian. This is typically described by local Lagrangian. You don't need no local pieces. So what we did, what they did here, simply slightly more complicated because this this pattern involves space-time. So it's a bit more complicated, but this is known, and then you get an effective Lagrangian, so a local action, one integral, it is known, yeah, and which is in terms of these Brannon fields. So I mean, there is no expectation of any non-local term here. So since I got this, can I ask you something? So yeah. I don't understand why you believe that should be a non-analyticity because you are expanding around zero. I mean, you would expect a non-analyticity. So the function is certainly non-analytic because it's an asymptotic series. This expansion in S, this is obvious. But then not necessarily you get non-analytic pieces in the expansion. I mean, you get non-analytic pieces in expansion if you would have infrared divergences in S. But this is a Goldstone boson. So in perturbation theory, I don't see why you would get infrared divergences. So that my guess is that you will not get these log S pieces. Or am I wrong? I mean, how can you get log S pieces?
Well, there are no infinite divergences, it's true, but...
Even if it is a Gaussian? You can get it? Okay, then I take it back. You get with some higher power of S in front. Okay.
Now, for example, to make it like an explicit example, if you do this computation at one loop, you would see that dimensional regularization, you get logs, dimensional regularization, but then when you restrict to the two-dimensional kinematics, there are not any more logs. And if you take chiral pions, for example, at one loop, there are logs. And these logs are needed to give an imaginary part and...
He replied to me, you will get with some higher power in front. So this, the Gaussian nature will be simply suppressed by some higher power.
Yeah.
Then,
okay.
If it takes. Okay.
I have a question. Do you.
That doesn't work.
I have a good. Do you plan to put upper bounds on the cross section, total cross section, and prove one day? Frosser bound, something like that, for Goldstone scattering. This would be really great. A big problem.
Yeah, that would be great. Maybe one day.
But
now.
No, but this particular process that you are studying, is it subject to the Frosser bound? Can you show something like that?
Yeah, it's true. Well, this is a very good question, but indeed, like there is little known. Like people even don't know if, like at high energies, this kind of theory becomes integrable, or if it's dominated by particle production. So people don't know much, and actually, I don't know about the fast bound in two dimensions, to be honest. But the high energy, for example, inputted energy behavior could be important to. Get better bounds, but we don't know about the energy behavior. That's mostly the problem.
Is there any way to put the global mass into your analysis? So far, you just put lambda L string. That was the only parameter. But we know that somewhere there's global.
Yeah, there is a way. For example, you could consider the coupled system where you have like flux tube Brannons. There is a global in the bulk, and they scatter and. You can consider the couple system. For example, it would be nice because the global, in a sense, like tuning the global coupling would be a way to tune also n, in the sense that we know that when n goes, the number of calls goes to infinity, they have to decouple. So when it's different from zero, it means that the theory is not large n anymore. So yeah, that's something that we are thinking about.
Okay, thank Andrea.